Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, as Democrats look toward 2028, should the candidates have a Trump-like quality?
And what Anora's big night at the Oscars suggests about the state of Hollywood entertainment.
But first, state lawmakers this week are set to debate two measures dealing with public utilities. Those are among the proposals on agendas during another busy week at the state capitol. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at 1700 West Washington, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning, but you're interrupting me coming up with five things I did last week to keep Elon Musk happy.
We've got plenty of things you did last week. So let's talk about a bill that is coming up for a debate in the House today, which would allow customers of electric utilities to opt out of service from their providers under certain circumstances. What circumstances might those be?
Well, this is really interesting because over the last couple of decades, there have been questions about should retail customers, you and I, be able to choose our electric providers? Now, there's all sorts of logistical reasons for that. If I live in SRP territory, I'm not sure that APS wants to come in, pay SRP to deliver its electrons. And it kind of failed. So what they've done now is suggested, or actually would tell the Corporation Commission, if your utility says, we are going for net zero. In other words, we want totally carbon-free emissions. Mm-hmm. Or if you have certain DEI policies, the customers get to opt out and choose another provider. Nobody has really suggested how that would work. Justin Olson, who was a former commissioner, said, oh, the commission will work it out. And yet the policy seems to be this, to get a backdoor way for open competition and looking for some excuse. Now, is there an argument to be made that you should have your choice of utilities? Sure. Now, how do you make that happen, given that the lines in front of your house are owned by APS or SRP or Tucson Electric? That's a whole nother question.
Yeah.
So it seems to be a philosophical argument versus an economic one.
Howie, does it seem as though this has been, as you referenced, changed a little bit as the process has moved along? Does it seem as though there might be more changes coming to this to make it maybe a little more logistically feasible?
Well, any of the changes have been what triggers the ability of someone to get out. As originally crafted, it would be if your utility was going to try to reduce carbon emissions. Now, all utilities are probably trying to reduce carbon emissions to the extent that we go more nuclear. You know, we keep talking about these small nuclear power plants. That utility would be reducing carbon emissions. They said, well, that's not a good trigger. So we're using the net zero. But again, there is nothing in the bill that says to the commission how you would accomplish this. And it could end up, from all the experience we went through decades ago, being more expensive. Again, if I'm in SRP territory and I want to buy electrons from Tucson Electric, Tucson Electric has to get me those electrons, run them through high tension wires owned by someone else, run them through SRP wires owned by them, and deliver them, and then have somebody figure out who's doing the billing. As I say, I think this is one of those ideological things versus anything that makes economic sense, but again, this is the Arizona legislature.
Right. So, Howie, another utility-related bill deals with wind farms and how close or far they have to be from people's homes or other property?
Exactly. Wind farms have become somewhat controversial on the idea of, are they killing birds? Do they cause noise? Do they cause, people to suffer effects from the sounds and everything else? And then there's the question of visual pollution. So what this legislation would do is say, if you want to erect a wind farm, you have to be at least 6 miles from anyone else's property. So we're not talking about you or me putting one up in our backyard, because the fact is no way that you were 6 miles from anywhere else.
Yeah.
And then if you want to build it to an area that's zoned for residential, it has to be at least 12 miles from that. The argument from the folks who came down, usually from Northeast Arizona, was that these things are a visual blight, that they cause noise, that they cause birds to die. And the you know, there are also a lot of folks saying, why are we investing in wind? Because wind is not necessarily a 24/7 operation like coal or like nuclear. Again, we've got a philosophical discussion going on here, and we're trying to go ahead and put into place with legislative solutions, which is never, never a good idea.
Interesting. Howie, there's another bill that's been moving through the process. A Senate committee will be debating it later this week. Basically, making sure that life in the fast lane stays for people who want to drive a little bit faster in the left side of the freeway?
Well, exactly. We've probably all been in a position where we're going up, let's say there's some stretches of Interstate 10, for example, north of Casa Grande and south of Chandler that are just two lanes in each direction. And if you want to get somewhere and you find some, I'll paint with a broad brush, some tourist saying, oh, look, Martha, there are cactus here, and traveling along at 45 miles an hour, it is very frustrating. So this would say, there's already is law, you're supposed to move over and travel in the slow lane. This would add some huge signs, you know, like 8 by 16 feet along the side of the road. B, remind people that there's a $250 fine for traveling in the fast lane when you shouldn't be. Now, they had to amend the bill to say, well, what if it's three lanes in each direction? Well, then you don't necessarily have to move over the right lane. You get the question of, well, which highways does this make sense on? Does this make sense, for example, on Interstate 10 going up the rim to get to Flagstaff, when in fact there are going to be people who are traveling below the speed limit in the left lane simply because that's as fast as your little Honda Civic might go.
Yeah.
But you know, this is an idea that a lot of folks is popular, but again, it's already law. This is more of a reminder to say, you know, move the hell over.
Interesting. All right. Howie Fisher, not sure if he's a Leadfoot or not, but
definitely.
Okay, fair enough. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Thank you as always, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Airlines and airports have been generating headlines quite a bit recently, from crashes to near misses to layoffs. And that includes here in Arizona, where a preliminary report from the National Transportation Safety Board last week found a jet that was involved in a crash at Scottsdale's airport had a problem with its landing gear. A crash at the Marana Airport is still under investigation. At the same time, cuts in the federal government are affecting the FAA, and an airline with a major presence in Phoenix recently announced layoffs. With me to talk about all this is Brett Snyder, also known as the Cranky Flyer. He runs a blog about the airline industry. Brett, nice to talk to you again. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
So there has been, as I referenced, quite a bit of discussion about airline safety with near misses and actual crashes going on. And a lot of discussion about, is this happening more frequently now, or maybe are we just hearing about it more? It seems as though the data suggests that there are not more incidents of this kind of thing happening now. Is that your read on it as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, look, aviation has become so safe in the United States that when there is an accident, then the media turns its focus toward what's happening. And so things like, for example, the go around in Chicago recently, if you saw that video of a Southwest airplane, those are fairly routine things that happen. And you just don't usually hear about it. But we're at this point now where there have been a couple of very high profile accidents. And so people are paying closer attention to it.
What kind of impact, if any, do you find that having on sort of the traveling public or maybe the way that airlines are doing their business?
Well, I don't think it's really changing anything in the way the airlines are doing their business. But for the traveling public, certainly there are some people who they're feeling more anxious about it. No question about that. Whether that means that they're rethinking their trips or delaying them or choosing to drive instead, it's probably too early to really know if there's any meaningful impact. But, you know, this has happened before. It's just been a really long time since we've had a fatal accident in the United States. So People tend to forget it, and it'll probably get back to normal as soon as things calm down in terms of demand.
Okay. In terms of some of the cuts that have been coming from the federal government, I referenced the FAA dealing with some layoffs, mostly, as in with other agencies, sort of what are called probationary employees, you know, a year or less or so on the job. What kind of impact might that have on the FAA and potentially on travel?
I wish we knew what kind of impact all of this was going to have, right?
Yeah.
It's all happening very quickly. So, you know, the FAA is saying they're not eliminating any safety-specific positions, but there are what I might call safety-adjacent positions.
Okay.
So it sounds like some of the roles that have been eliminated, for example, are people who do maintenance on safety systems. And so technically, they are not directly safety related, but if systems go down and need maintenance and they can't get them up as quickly again, then it could certainly cause delays or, depending upon the system, mm-hmm. It could have some impact, right? So we don't really know what that impact would be, but it shouldn't impact, for example, air traffic controllers or people that are directly related to that. Everything's just happening so quickly in the federal government right now that it's hard to really pinpoint exactly what this means.
Well, given that uncertainty, and you referenced the speed with which a lot of this is happening, how is the industry trying to adapt and maybe try to figure out what the impacts might be?
Look, I mean, the airlines all have people in Washington that are on the ground that are trying to make sure that they're on top of all of this as it's happening.
Yeah.
But they're also just trying to be responsive as well. Really interesting note from last weekend is that for May travel, American Airlines obviously has a big hub in Phoenix, mm-hmm. but also has is the largest airline at Washington's close-in National Airport. They actually substituted a lot of smaller aircraft for larger ones in Washington, suggesting that there may be less demand in Washington with all the changes that are going on. So, you know, they're trying to react as quickly as they can, but each week brings something new.
Yeah, that is interesting. So, Brett, I want to ask you, speaking of another airline that has a major presence here, Southwest announced some pretty substantial layoffs coming up. What does that tell you about maybe the state of Southwest, maybe the state of the airline industry more broadly?
Yeah, they did. They announced a pretty significant layoff to non-union, non-frontline workers, so mostly headquarters staff, things like that. And it's the first one in their more than 50 years of existence. So it's a really big development for Southwest.
Yeah.
I don't think that this really says anything about the industry more broadly. This is really about Southwest itself. You have an activist investor that started to build a stake in Southwest last year. It sees an airline that it thinks is underperforming. It thinks it can make a lot more money if Southwest just starts making change. And I guess this kind of ties to what we're talking about, the federal government. They're trying to make things change very quickly. And so this is one of those things that has been a result of that. And it certainly has an impact on the culture at Southwest since they've never done this before. But you know, what this means, is this the end of change? Is there more coming? We don't really know, but I would put my money on more change coming until they're able to get short-term results that are better so they can make their money as an activist investor.
Sure. Lots still to keep our eyes on there. All right. That is Brett Snyder, the Cranky Flyer. Brett, good to talk to you as always. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, does Disney's Oscar-winning desert documentary need a fact check?
You know, I was puzzled. Why did Disney do these things? Why did he alter nature? Because nature is really interesting in and of itself, in its natural state.
A Tucson-based professor shares her misgivings about 1953's The Living Desert.
But first, the independent film Anora won big at last night's Oscars. The small-budget movie about an exotic dancer who impulsively marries the son of a Russian oligarch and then loses track of him on a wild night in Brighton Beach took home 5 statues. Iconoclastic director Sean Baker, who also wrote and edited the film, was basically the star of the show. Joining us to break down the significance of Anora's triumph is Phoenix Magazine film critic Mark Moorhead. He spoke with the show's Sam Dingman.
Mark, well, good morning. It's wonderful to talk to you about the Sean Baker show. I mean, the Oscars.
Yeah, no kidding. That's about right.
What did you make of the big night for Anora? That seems like an obvious place to start.
Sure, and it was a very big night. I gotta tell you, I didn't think Anora was the best picture of the year. I thought it was pretty good.
What were the movies that, you know, if it was the Mark Moorhead Oscars, yeah. Who would you have liked to see?
Yeah, that would have been a pretty low rating, I'm afraid. But the big thing that I wanted out of last night I did get, and that was my favorite movie of the year, which was Flow, the Latvian animated movie about the little kitty. No movie this year moved me as much as that or amused me as much as that or was as beautiful to me, I thought, as that. And it did win. It was nominated in 2 categories. It won for Best Animated Feature. And so I was good as far as that went. But Anora, it really wandered around, I thought, in the second half and really kind of it became as tedious as an actual night where you're out looking for somebody that you can't find,
right.
You know, in my opinion. Not necessarily unrealistically, just not in a way that I thought was particularly edifying. So I think that there's a lot of talent in that movie, including Sean Baker.
Well, it's interesting that you mention, you know, the talent of Sean Baker in terms of what to call out about that movie, because I'd love to get your take on this. I was trying to remember another Oscar night where it felt not just so dominated by one movie, but by one particular person's artistic perspective.
The one that leaps to mind, it was one of the most boring Oscar shows in recent memory that I can recall, was the one where one of the Lord of the Rings pictures claimed a whole bunch of them. And you certainly could link that to one person, Peter Jackson.
Right.
An absolute bona fide genius. But it was not an interesting show as far as that as far as that went. Even if you argued, as some might, that the movie deserved it, it just wasn't good TV.
Well, and it also seems to me, you know, like we get together to watch the Oscars every year. We anticipate the Oscars, you know, think about who the host is going to be because we're kind of anticipating wanting to have something to make fun of.
Of course.
And it sort of seems like a false hope that it's going to be a quote unquote good show.
Of course. And I don't think a good show is actually what people want. I have long believed that part of what we love about the Oscars, because they usually are atrociously overwhelming. The best joke last night was Conan O'Brien saying, if you're still enjoying the show, it's what we call Stockholm Syndrome. but I think it's what we want. I think we want it to be lame and bloated and a weird throwback to an old school form of TV variety show. And one of the things that we enjoy about griping about it is that the show doesn't give us that feel that it gave us when we were kids, that excitement and that glamour and that thrill. It just seems tired now, and that's what when we're griping about that, I think we're griping a little bit about our lost youth.
Right. Well, so that makes me think about one of the big things people seem to be talking about with this year's Oscars that I'd be curious to get your take on is this idea that we have gotten so far from the time when movies were monoculture and that
true.
By and large, with the films that were nominated this year and the films that won, Flo and Anora being 2 examples of
sure.
this, these are movies that, broadly speaking, not that many people saw.
Right.
A lot of people probably found out about for the first time watching the broadcast
indeed.
Last night. And that I saw, I believe it was Wesley Morris this morning, said last year during the whole Barbenheimer phenomenon, it was less that those movies watered the desert and more that they were a mirage, and that this year was kind of a truer reflection of where we are.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that had great success were kind of outsider movies. And the whole way there was that sort of plaintive begging for people to go back to the theater that was included in the show last night. It was quite funny. Conan's bit about like a streaming service where you actually go to a building and see a movie on the screen.
On 800 iPhones glued to the wall.
Together. Exactly. You know, that was very clever. There was that assertion that we all fell in love with movies at the theater. I certainly did. Maybe you did too.
Absolutely.
It's very true for many people, but I don't think it's true for everybody. I think even not necessarily just talking about young people, but even somewhat older people fell in love with movies thanks to the VHS tape, thanks to the VCR.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. That, you know, I mean, if you think about people who were sort of coming of age as consumers, like the kinds of people who would have their own Netflix account right around the time it converted to streaming and all these other cord-cutting services came along, it's not Gen Z. It's not so much the phone generation that we tend to ascribe that to culturally. It's more folks, like you're saying, like the Blockbuster generation, people who rented tapes. And
believe me, I agree with the whole Cinema Paradiso communal experience thing. It's definitely for me, but it is decreasingly the same for everybody, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, we alluded to earlier, Baker in winning Best Original Screenplay, Best Directing, Best Editing, and I guess in taking Best Picture, he has really put his artistic stamp on the Oscars this year.
Sure.
And it would seem to put him in a position to be kind of a standard bearer. What do you think the implications of that are?
There aren't any implications necessarily. None that are for sure. He may go on to have a fantastic career, but if you look at Best Pictures over the years, it's very, very common for them not to be the movies that we remember. Now, I think this guy will get a lot of interest because, you know, he won Best Picture with a $6 million movie.
Yeah.
And people are going to pay attention to that.
Well, and it will be interesting to see. A lot of times I think directors in his position who run the table the way he did, and to your point, do so on such a shoestring budget, are then invited to take the wheel of really big ticket movies.
I think, if you get your chance to be promoted from, you know, a lieutenant to brigadier general of some, you know, whole massive division, then I think you probably take it.
Yeah, well, and I know there's a lot of people who are big fans of these smaller indie directors who get concerned about them selling out when they take on these big movies.
Oh, of course.
But if we look at these examples, I mean, Gerwig with Barbie.
Yeah. She went very big budget, but it was nobody's going to suggest that was some sellout,
exactly,
you know, by the numbers movie. It was this very imaginative piece of work. So, you know, she brought that to big budget filmmaking, and that's when something can get really interesting.
All right. Well, that is M.V. Moorhead, a film critic for Phoenix Mag, joining us this morning to recap last night's Oscars. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's less than 2 months into the second Trump term, and Democrats are already looking toward the next presidential election. And the candidate that's got the most buzz right now is not a career politician or a sitting senator. It's Stephen A. Smith, an ESPN host with a podcast and a large audience of young men. And lately, he's gotten into the political realm a whole lot more.
With the first order of business in the world of politics, because I don't know if y'all saw what the hell happened on TV today. Live national television, live international television as well. Y'all got to see this if y'all haven't said it, because that's exactly where I'm getting started. It's in the nation's capital with a nation. So President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance have a testy exchange with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It all happened in front of reporters during their meeting at the White House this afternoon with the cameras rolling. Keep that in mind.
And our next guest this morning says he could win. E.J. Montini is a columnist for the Arizona Republic, and he joins us this morning to talk more about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's first just tell us a little bit about Stephen A. Smith. For those of us who are not familiar, maybe not in the sports world, who is he?
Well, Stephen A. Smith is he was originally a sports writer and columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He went on to ESPN, and because he's out there, he's loud, he's in your face, he's blustery, all that kind of stuff, he's probably one of their most popular host figures, does everything. And he has sort of crossed over now. I mean, he also is now doing some small things with politics. And so he's one of those people that is, he would tell you that he is progressive socially and conservative fiscally, that kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he can be funny. He can be in your face. He can be articulate. He's a very good media presence. And that, I think, is why in a very surprising thing in one of the early Democratic polls, he came up with 2% of the vote at a time when no one even considered him to be something of a candidate.
Right. Very much the bottom, still 2%, right? But getting a lot of buzz, lots of people writing about him and this possibility, this idea of somebody like him. He himself, though, said, like, it's an embarrassment that people are looking at him as a candidate.
Exactly. Yeah. What's important is not necessarily he himself, but someone like him or someone who shares those qualities, because one of the things that Stephen A. Smith is doing right now is something that a very smart Democratic contender would be trying to do. I mean, Stephen A. Smith's audience basically is ESPN, which is a huge young male demographic, of course.
Yeah.
He's into podcasts. He has a very popular podcast. Again, you're getting a lot of young people in it. And he now makes regular appearances on Fox. You know, the old saying about keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Well, he appears on Fox now and he does very well. And they like him because he's in their face and he comes back. So he's been on Hannity. He's been on O'Reilly. He does a lot of different shows. I mean, in the ideal sense, that is exactly what a serious Democratic contender for president should be doing.
That makes a lot of sense, right? In the media way. But what I wonder is, maybe Democrats need somebody, right, with sizzle, as you write about. He said, you know, we need a candidate with sizzle, somebody who's combative, somebody with a big media personality. But do Democrats need a politician? Like, what about experience?
No. I mean, look at it from Trump's point of view, you know? I mean, it's like the fact of the matter is, I do not think, I think these days, charisma is more important than political experience. And I'm not sure it hasn't always been that way to a degree. I mean, I think we've had some presidential candidates, presidential winners who were very good at their jobs and also were sort of charismatic. But you know, you go down the line of the people who had the most charisma. You know, John F. Kennedy was very young for being a president. You know, Reagan, while he had been governor of California, you know, his experience was limited as well. Obama was certainly limited. But what those guys shared was that they just had that something that gets people interested in them. And that's, I think, what someone like Stephen A. Smith is arguing for. You know, have somebody out there who speaks to the people that you're trying to reach, the people that you're having the hardest time reaching.
Is this, Ed, the change in politics that will never go back, maybe because of the Trump effect? Like somebody like Donald Trump comes in and blows up the political, you know, status quo, and now we have to start thinking differently on all sides.
Well, I think that in the short term, I think that's true for sure. I don't know if that'll last forever, but it's certainly true in the short term. I mean, even if you look at the way he conducts his general business now, you know, it's so much about, for instance, with his stuff with Zelensky recently, it's so much about the appearance of toughness rather than actual toughness. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a performance rather than something that's actually real. And there's an element to that that I think, you know, that you would hope that is what a president does to get elected, not when he's in office. And unfortunately, that's not happening, you know, and maybe the person who does defeat someone like Trump recognizes that you have to have a little bit of that sizzle, a little bit of that, a considerable amount of charisma actually to get in. But once you're in, you're going to be serious about the job. It's going to be tough. You know, Democrats want to be policy wonks. I saw Hakeem Jeffries on TV, the Democratic leader, and boasting about how, like, you know, we're winning in court. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's all well and good, but you're not winning in the court of public opinion. And that's really important.
Let me ask you lastly about men here. Like, this is so much about, you know, getting the male vote. The last election ended up being very much about getting young men and disenfranchised men and white men to vote in ways that they don't always do. Women vote more regularly than men in most elections. Is that a miss by Democrats to focus on that if it's already a demographic that's kind of gone toward Trump?
No, you just have to understand how to reach them. You know, I mean, it seemed like some things that Trump did, he would go to sort of like MMA fights. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, he not only, I'm sure he sort of appreciates that kind of thing, but at the same time, he's trying to reach the people that he needs to reach. You know, I mean, Democrats sort of tried to figure that out a little bit toward the end, you know, and it has to be somewhat sincere. You have to find somebody who, in approaching that kind of stuff, is real about the way they're looking for it, because they're not going to come to you. You have to go to them. And that's a tough call for Democrats right now. I mean, I don't see anyone on the immediate close horizon who's doing that. And I think that's what Stephen A. Smith is talking about. You know, he's asking, like, where is that person? And it's a really good question. And it should be something, no matter where it comes from, even from this guy on who's an ESPN sports guy, and people are thinking, why are we paying attention to him? It's because he's asking really good questions about Democrats, and they should be paying attention to him.
All right. Well, lots to watch for there. That is the Arizona Republic's columnist E.J. Montini joining us. Ed, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it as always.
Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. It was an eventful few days for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky last week, as he had a contentious meeting in the Oval Office and then headed to London, where the reception was much more positive. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross. And Pete, honestly, not entirely sure how to describe that meeting at the White House, but after that and the gathering in London, what's been the reaction in Europe so far, and what should we look out for this week?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to describe it either, Mark. But I mean, I think we can say that it's certainly been an extraordinary few days we've just had in international diplomacy, Ukraine's future, and from where I'm sitting, speaking to you today, European security at the forefront of our minds as well. Currently, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is now back in Kyiv after three frantic days, which, as we've mentioned, saw him ordered to leave the White House on Friday after a tense and very public showdown with Donald Trump and J.D. Vance in Washington. The Ukrainian leader found a warmer welcome, however, here in London on the weekend, where he was greeted by the Prime Minister outside Downing Street, visited the King, and received a strong show of support from European leaders at a summit on Sunday yesterday, in sharp contrast to those scenes we've discussed in the Oval Office. Now, after the London summit, Sir Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, suggested European leaders should form a coalition of the willing, in his words, to defend Ukraine, but details of who would contribute, well, those are scarce at the moment, so look for details of that in the coming days. How have other European leaders reacted? Tweets in support of Zelensky have poured in over the weekend. One notable European leader who's not supporting Zelensky, at least he's not tweeted support, is Hungary's Viktor Orban. He's well known to be, close to President, to Russia's Vladimir Putin. Now, by the time the London summit came around, which, by the way, I think it's important to point out that that's actually been in the diary for quite some time.
Yeah.
But of course, it took on greater significance in the aftermath of Friday's events. At the summit, there was a sense that concrete action had to follow words of support, with most leaders careful to highlight that they still considered US support essential. So it's kind of a balancing act. I think the main thing to concentrate on, Mark, is that a lot has been said in the last 48 or 72 hours, a lot of proclamations, a lot of suggestions. But has anything concrete come out of that? Is there any plan that Europe is unified on that can then be taken back to Washington? I would say at the moment, not yet. So watch this space, because that's what needs to happen now. We've had some proposals. Now we need to see some concrete plans that can be taken to Washington.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch for sure. Okay, Pete, let's move a little bit closer to us here in the U.S. Canada's ruling Liberal Party will be choosing a new leader to replace Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who, of course, said in January he would be stepping down after growing dissatisfaction over his performance. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, the race to replace Justin Trudeau will come to an end on Sunday when, as you say, his Liberal Party chooses its next leader. It will bring to an end Justin Trudeau's nine-year stretch as leader and 9 years as Prime Minister of the country. The race has been running, as you say, since he stepped down in January, but it's going to come to a head on Sunday. And the leader will be announced at the end of, once the votes are counted. Looking at the polls right now, suggests that the ex-central bank governor, Mark Carney, has a commanding lead over the former finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, whose resignation last December triggered the crisis that led to Trudeau stepping down. So, yeah, it looks like at the moment Mark Carney is in line to take the hot seat. If he does win the vote, he's going to have to hit the ground running. He'll become prime minister, but Canada has a fixed term parliament, so there's set to be an election must take place in Canada no later than October. However, I think he will be under extreme pressure to call one earlier than that because, of course, you know, he hasn't been voted for as prime minister by all Canadians, just a small selection that are members of his Liberal Party. So expect to see whoever is announced as winner on Sunday, the pressure for an election. And of course, you'll also have whoever wins, they'll also have quite a lot on their plate, not least the continued threat of tariffs being imposed by Donald Trump. And of course, he continues to suggest that Canada is the 51st state rather than a sovereign country. So lots to deal with for whoever wins that race.
Absolutely. All right, Pete, finally, let's go to China now, where that country's annual two sessions where Beijing lays out its key policy priorities for the year opens up this week. What can we expect from that?
Yeah, events in Beijing, I reckon, are going to be closely watched. As you say, China's political elites and lawmakers are gathering for what's colloquially referred to as, I guess, the two sessions. The gathering usually lasts about a week, and it's a chance for Beijing to lay out, as you've mentioned, its key priorities for the year ahead. I think what we can expect is a continued focus on economic growth. China still hasn't really completely rebounded from the COVID pandemic, and of course, it's got the ongoing potential trade war with Washington, with the threat of further tariffs being imposed on the import of some goods from China. That's actually more tariffs. Further tariffs are set to come in from Washington this week. However, I don't think the economy is the only thing that's on the agenda or the only thing of interest for international watchers. The meeting will discuss a wide range of issues for China's government, not least its military, as it continues to try and expand its influence in the South Pacific and beyond. And one other area I reckon we might get some big announcements on is AI and the development of AI in China. You'll remember in January the emergence of the Chinese AI startup DeepSeek, which included an AI chatbot that, according to Beijing, cost a fraction of the cost of more established chatbots like ChatGPT, briefly sending shockwaves through the industry that suggests that China could be a bigger player in the AI market or the AI sector than was previously thought. So look out for some announcements on that this week as well.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Always great to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Susan Swanberg grew up fascinated by a certain Disney documentary that was shot mostly in the Tucson area called The Living Desert.
How anything can live in this harsh region remains a mystery to most of us. And yet where we find only a dead and desolate wasteland,
Nature finds life.
It won the 1954 Oscar for Best Documentary, and it depicted life in the desert, including scorpion courtship, tortoise fights, and one scene Swanberg remembers particularly well between a tarantula and a wasp.
A tarantula it must be, and a tarantula it is. Now they are met face to face, and this is a sight few have ever witnessed. In this strange encounter, the spider battles for its life. The wasp for generations yet to come. For only through the tarantula can she ensure the propagation of her line.
The film sparked her interest in the natural world, and she grew up to be a scientist, a geneticist, biologist, and science journalist. Today, she teaches in the journalism school at the University of Arizona, where she showed experts excerpts of the living desert in her classes for her students. But they started to question how accurate it might actually be. It's the subject of her latest paper, published in the International Journal of Disney Studies, and I spoke with her more about it.
Because my students would show me things that, or point out things that they thought were interesting, like the creatures all were named and they behaved like human beings, and there were some cultural things. They kind of portrayed a 50s era cultural values.
In a film that was credited and won the Oscar, right, for a documentary?
Yes, yes. But it was more personality driven. As a matter of fact, the narrator for the film, Winston Hibbler, said it was Walt Disney's way to look on animals as personalities, as struggling, striving little creatures facing problems not unlike our own.
Huh.
And that's what Disney often did with both his cartoons and also his true life adventures.
So there's plenty of anthropomorphism in here, right?
Yes.
Tell us about some of the inaccuracies you have discovered here in the course of writing this paper. It sounds like they're pretty numerous, like they used pets.
Yes. And one of the fun things that I did with this was when I figured out that it had been shot largely, or a lot of it had been shot in Tucson or the larger Tucson area, I thought, I'm going to check our local newspaper archives and see if I can find any reference. And I found all sorts of references to where it was filmed and to, for example, in the case of pets, one of the Tucsonans' pet tortoises became main characters in one of the vignettes, where these tortoises were roommates. They lived in the same home, and one of them was a cantankerous oldster who would battle the other tortoises, and he was notorious for flipping them over on their back. Well, in the Disney movie, these three tortoises, a female and two males, the two males were fighting over the female, and it was shown as a natural courtship ritual.
Right.
But the cantankerous oldster flipped over the younger guy.
Finally, it's tortoise turned turtle. 8, 9, 10, you're out. He's not only lost his dignity, he may lose his life.
And then there was a lot of drama over whether he would reorient himself in time to avoid dying from the heat. So it was made into a real dramatic interlude.
Oh, wow. Interesting. And there's the infamous sort of scorpion dance that seems to have been a little bit altered.
All right, everybody. Choose your partners for the stingaree. Lady and gent to the center of the ring. Lock those claws, lift that sting. Three legs up and four legs down. Whirl that scorpion round and round.
Yes, the scorpion dance. Scorpions, there are some elements of that dance that are real and accurate representations of the natural world, because the male and the female do clasp claws in their courtship ritual.
Right, right.
However, in Disney's movie, he made it into a real dance sequence with reverse action, stop and reverse action. And he set it to music with a mouth harp, I think it was. So it sounded like a square dance.
So you start to sort of dig into this after your students ask these questions and find some of these real kind of inaccuracies, things that are not exactly the way things are in nature.
Right.
How did you feel about it? Like, as somebody who grew up watching this, it sounds like it was a big kind of part of your childhood. Did you feel betrayed?
Well, I wouldn't say I felt betrayed, but I was puzzled because, you know, I turned into a real scientist. I actually got a PhD in genetics. And, you know, I was puzzled. Why did Disney do these things? Why did he alter nature? Because nature is really interesting in and of itself in its natural state. But I had several different feelings at the same time because his movies did inspire people. It inspired my father, or helped inspire him to want to move west.
Right.
It inspired me as far as an interest in the doings of the natural world. And it actually inspired at least one biologist who became a herpetologist, and he had watched The Living Desert as a child. So, you know, there were some good things about it. It's just that it portrayed nature in a way that nature didn't need us to protect it. And I wonder if, you know, my generation, the baby boom generation, was impacted by these movies that didn't accurately portray the interactions of creatures in their natural habitats. You know, they were portrayed as creatures who could do for themselves, and that's not really true.
Do you think it impacted you and the way that you looked at the natural world for a lot of your life?
Well, probably not, because it merely piqued my interest, like the tarantula and wasp battle, where the wasp stings the tarantula, paralyzes it, and then drags it down to its burrow. It sounds pretty horrific, actually.
Yes.
But it drags the paralyzed tarantula down to its burrow and then lays a single egg in it. The egg hatches and eats the fresh meat as it develops.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, on the tarantula's body, she will lay a single egg. Soon, a new wasp will emerge, feed on the paralyzed spider, and then one day venture forth to replay this grim desert drama.
So it actually piqued my interest in some of the interesting relationships in nature. And
yeah,
some of them are a little grim and gruesome, but, you know, that's the way nature is.
Yeah, that is the way nature is.
A lot of it is beautiful and exciting and fascinating, but there are these elements. You know, and Disney didn't whitewash this incident with the tarantula and the wasp.
So, I mean, there's this idea of, like, edutainment you get at here. You tried to prove even, right, that Disney himself, Walt Disney himself, actually invented that term. Is that
yes,
the case?
I'm not sure, actually. You know, I did a lot of research. I searched and searched high and low to find any articles that definitively prove that he coined that word. But I couldn't find that. There were lots of people who wrote that he did, but I didn't find the actual proof. But he did, in fact, say in a different interview that it wasn't his goal to educate, it was his goal to entertain. So while he might not have coined the word edutainment, he really did want to entertain people with his movies. And I was certainly entertained as a child.
And you use the film now to kind of teach your students about this reality, right? To teach them about vetting information, which is an important thing for all of us to learn.
Yes, exactly. And that's a subtopic of my other research, is misinformation, how it's handled, how it arises. And so, yes, I teach my students to do what I call, and other people have called, lateral reading, where you read a multiple of sources and from a multitude of experts, so that you don't just get one image of things. One of the things I wonder about is, because it's still available on Disney Plus and still shown in classrooms, how does it impact people's view of the natural world now?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we'll leave it there. That is Susan Swanberg, Associate Professor in the U of A School of Journalism, joining us from Tucson. Susan, thank you so much.
And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.